I chose the painting A Mountain Climber by Jolif Willumsen of a woman standing on the top of a mountain, looking out. Something about the color palette, expressive, surreal, psychedelic, strong, coming from our flat little country of Denmark, living here in Los Angeles. I connect with the desert and the mountain ranges and the Pacific Ocean and that kind of hugeness in nature. I look out and I see three-dimensional mountain ranges and I suddenly have this perspective, this adventurer that she represents. I kind of like have a feeling of that wanderlust that I've had in my life. I see that in that painting as well.
My name is Tine Jung Christensen, and I'm the host of Danish Originals, a podcast series created in partnership with the American Friends of the National Gallery of Denmark and the National Gallery of Denmark. Our goal is to celebrate Danish creatives who've made a significant mark in the US. Today, our guest is Jan Fo, a Danish musician and singer from the band Ravionettes. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you so much.
It's lovely to have you here. So we meet you in Los Angeles, where you lived for a very long time, but now you are back in Denmark. What made you decide to move back?
Yes. Oh, what a good question. Well, actually, I was living abroad for 17 years, London, New York, and then here in LA for about 12 years. Oh. And I was homesick. I was longing for Europe and Denmark at that time. This was back in 2019. And I was also, to be honest with you, I had just gone through a divorce and the Ravionettes was taking a long break, a hiatus, possibly forever. So it was a total collapse of my personal life as well and professional life. So I wanted to go back to Denmark and explore my professional options and also start to, I don't know, I was like, you know, I think at this adult stage in my life, I'd like to go back to Denmark and nourish where I come from and be closer to my parents and my sister and my brother and my family there as well. So that was what happened. It's that thing where, you know, what I was created by, I think the sense that the country that I come from has soft grass, contrary to the, you know, succulents here and cacti, which I love as well. But I think just that sense of, you know, the rain and the fresh air and biking around the city and meeting my people that I know just on the corner of the street, being in a city that I could walk around and bike around. There was just certain things that I was longing for in terms of lifestyle. And also at the time, 2019, honestly, the political environment here in the US was hard for me to reconcile with. I thought it was a tough time. And yeah, I wanted to go back and see what was going on in Denmark.
Mm-hmm. What was it like then to move back? I've been here for years and I'm sort of worried that I will have a culture shock or something if I return someday in the future. Was it like sort of just settle in?
I actually did settle in. I mean, of course, at first it was a little bit like, what am I doing and what am I supposed to do here? You know, and I was trying to explore my options in terms of work and my artistic life. But I really found that I had a really strong community there still. And to be honest with you, Ravionettes, we've done great around the world. I mean, we're still touring the US and we get offers to go to China and da da da. But honestly, coming back to Denmark, we are high profiled in Denmark. So there's certain possibilities that we have there where it's just easier and more accessible. The US is still a big country to make an impact in career-wise. So in that regard, being like a bigger fish in a smaller pond, rather than a little fish in a really big pond, really big ocean. So there was that. I actually just settled in quite easily. I really loved, I was like, even when it was raining, I was like, oh, this feels so great. I love this. The seasons, which I had missed when I was living in the US or living here in LA, where it's more of one season, two seasons. Mm-hmm. I think I had a kind of a romantic experience with coming back to Denmark, actually. It wasn't that hard for me. I hear it from other friends of mine that have lived abroad for many years that they feel unsettled. I will say that I did pretty soon start a job there. I'm an adjunct professor at the conservatory in Denmark. So, you know, having colleagues and a place to work, I think that was also part of, you know, integrating like pretty quickly into the pulse of the city.
A community.
I mean, sometimes, particularly my daughter will say this to me. She's like, wow, this is so homogenous here. Missing maybe the diversity that you experience here. That kind of colorfulness and diversity that we have here in LA is quite, I mean, it's inspiring. And I think that broadens your horizon also. Yeah, that was something that I was like, wow, everybody's looking kind of the same. And we're having the same bag. And, you know, there's a homogenous sort of experience of Denmark, mm-hmm. which is both great. And sometimes maybe you can miss that. A more experimental edginess that we also have in LA or mm-hmm. in bigger, more, you know, yeah, bigger places, mm-hmm. diverser places.
Let's go back in time, actually, to the very beginning when you were born in Emmeloo.
Yes.
On Djursland. Okay, yeah. What kind of environment did you grow up in?
Yeah, born in Grenaa Hospital. And my parents were from the suburbs of Copenhagen and actually were part of a community from around Copenhagen that moved to the countryside to have a different lifestyle of being closer to nature. You could say that it was more like a hippie community that I grew up in. They actually started their own school there as an alternative to the public school that was available for us there. So in a sense, I grew up in a little bit of a, I would say, Copenhagen island in Jutland. That was my experience of my childhood. We had a lot of music at the school, which I am always very grateful for. My teacher there, Jens Falk, was very formative for me in terms of starting to play music.
And your dad was a musician
My
too?
Dad was a musician, yeah. He actually was in a band with Jens, who was my music teacher. They were in a band called Djursland Spillemænd, which are known for the song Jyske Knejte.
Yeah.
They recorded this song as a kind of a homage or a celebration of Christiania. It's a free town. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where I grew up. A very sort of colorful, funky childhood.
And you went up to go to Rytmisk Musikkonservatorium. Mm-hmm. That's a music conservatory in Denmark. What kind of foundation did that give you?
I remember realizing that I was like, wow, you can actually choose music as a profession and a job and you can take an education. So yeah, I applied to study there and I studied there for 5 years. I took my master's at the conservatory as a singer, mm-hmm. which was my main instrument. I suppose what that gave me was, of course, education within music, you know, understanding and learning and acquiring technical skills and musical skills and artistic skills, but also very much of a community, being part of a community and people that played music. So there was that, but also when I was getting close to the end of my education, I really also felt, because at the time, I will say the school was not really a school that was very concerned with your artistic expression. It was more of, you know, technique, that there was a particular way to play music. I mean, I was missing this notion of what's the artistic sort of imprint, you know. I was looking for someone outside of that. I sang a lot of jazz music and I was looking for something more contemporary and something with more of an individual artistic expression. And then I met Sune Wagner, who's my mm-hmm. partner in the Ravenettes, and we started playing together. And yeah, that's...
What was the initial meeting with him like?
Yeah, well, Sune, we were sort of moving around in some circles in Copenhagen that were the sort of indie rock, alternative rock sort of community in Copenhagen. Copenhagen is a tiny city, so you kind of know everyone that's into the same kind of music that you are. So I was moving in the jazz circles and then the indie rock circles, my communities, and the sort of avant-garde improvisation, bebop, jazz, and then the rock community. For instance, I sang a lot with Pernille Rosendahl, who's mm-hmm. also a Danish singer, and I was doing backing vocals for her band Swan Lee at the time for a period of time, and just trying to navigate what was going to happen. And then when I did my, what do you call it, when I just finished the conservatory, I had a big celebration together with Randi Laubek, who's another Danish singer. We had a big party at a folk high school. Mm-hmm. And people were spending the night there. There was like 100 people. And then I had just started this band called Vamp Camp, where I played bass because I wanted to sort of get back to something more fun. I was a little bit fatigued with education and singing jazz. And so I had this punk band that I started with two girls. One of them was actually Christina Rosendahl, who's a film director. She played drums and I played bass and then this other girl, and we were making our own costumes, sewing our own costumes. It was just, you know, sort of DIY attitude and fun. And I loved playing bass because I enjoyed having an instrument that didn't feel so serious to me in a way, just this kind of playfulness. When you study music for 5 years with vocals as your main instrument, it becomes a very serious thing. And I just needed to do something that kind of shook it all up. And then Sune was at that party. And gosh, this is a long story. Sorry. So Sune was at the party and he was looking for someone to start a new band with. And he had written all these new songs in Seattle, where he had been staying for some time. And he was like, let's try out these new songs I have. And I'm looking for starting a band with another singer. I want to really try and work with boy-girl vocal harmonies. He was very inspired by the Everly Brothers and that way of, you know, singing together and vocal harmonies. So we sat down and then immediately our voices just blended so naturally. And it just, yeah, it just was kind of an instant match. Wow. Musically. So that was the beginning back in 1999.
Yeah. Wow. What made you decide that it was going to be an only sort of boy-girl duo? Why just the two of you?
We did actually have a third person in the band at first, but we kicked him out. I guess, you know, the simplicity of being two. It's nice to be two and not just be alone, but it's also, there's something very simple about, you know, just being two people. Yeah. We just had a good way of complementing each other. The darkness and the lightness, we're kind of a yin-yang, yin-yang duo. Yeah, you know, we play live with lots of different musicians. We have different constellations live, but just, it's a very simple, dogmatic expression with the two of us, I think.
And only two to make the decisions also makes things easier, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah,
it does. There was a writer from Rolling Stones who wrote about you after having seen you on the Spot Festival in Aarhus.
Right.
What did this exposure and the fact that he praised you mean to your band, the Rabionettes?
Well, I mean, it was a big break for us in a way. Of course, it was very meaningful for us because David Frick, you know, he's lived that period that we're so inspired by, you know, the whole punk era in New York in the 70s with the Ramones and Blondie and Richard Hell and the Void. I mean, he's sort of lived it, and then recognizing that heritage that our music is built on, and then, of course, hopefully also contributing with something new. We were very excited that he recognized that and appreciated it. And then it also, of course, gave us an opportunity to try and break into the US. I mean, our big dream was to have a career outside of Denmark. So yeah, in that sense, it was a kind of a break for us.
And you were pretty ambitious right from the beginning and also pretty business-minded. You actually planned for David Frick to hear you back then. Where did this ambition come from and how did you plan it? Talk about that.
Wow. Where did the ambition come from? I don't know. We were just very ambitious. You know, we were in our 20s, you know, that period of time when you're in your life and you're just like, I want to conquer the world.
Invincible.
Yeah. We really felt like we had something special. Mm. We really were like, this music is so good. and the world needs to hear it. That's really how we felt. Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing.
And then, yeah, it was this whole thing where we had a booker. We had really just played, I think when we played Spot Festival, it was maybe the fifth show in our entire career. Okay. We were new. And we had a booker that couldn't get us booked on the Spot Festival. So we actually had to fire him and hire someone who promised us that he could get us on the Spot Festival. And we knew that the year before that Mew had been discovered by the international music industry and got a big record deal in England. And we were like, that's what we want to do. And David Frigg is coming. And he needs to hear us because he'll get it. And, you know, so we got on the bill. Actually, in the program, at the time, we hadn't even really decided on the name of the band. So in the Spot program, we were the Shades. But we quickly realized it's too generic.
How did you come up with the Ravenettes?
The Ravenettes is kind of a complicated name, but what it is, it's really, it's Rave On, which is a Buddy Holly song. Mm-hmm. So that's a reference to our heritage, musical heritage. And then Etz, you know, the Ronettes, the Chamettes, the Marvelettes, it's all the girl groups from the early 60s. So it's, in a way, it's carrying some of our inspirations on our sleeve and in our name. So it's like that, a reference to, yeah, our musical inspirations.
The attention that David Frick gave you did end up leading you to the United States.
Right.
You started in New York, as you mentioned before. How does this adventure start? Talk about starting fresh in a really big city.
Yeah, we booked a show at CBGB's on the Lower East Side in Manhattan, which was, at least in the 70s, the epicenter of the punk scene with the Ramones and Blondie, and a really vibrant scene that we were very inspired by. And so we got a job there and played a concert there. Dave Frick was there and wrote a raving review on rollingstone.com. And then I remember it's the next 4 months, we got interest from, I think, 18 record labels from around the world. We were flown around and wined and dined. And I remember we were playing at the Troubadour in LA. It was a crappy slot as the first out of four bands, but Universal Music wanted to see us play. It was all these showcases we were doing, and we were staying in these fabulous hotels with free bar and
dangerous stuff.
It was so fabulous. I have some memories from LA at the Beverly Wilshire, it was called at the time, which had the view of the entire Hollywood. We were up by the pool, and they let us stay there all night because we told them that the guy in the hot tub was Moby. It was really our drummer, Jakob, but he kind of looked like Moby. I don't know.
It
was like rock star behavior before we had even signed with a label. I don't know. But then at a certain point, we need to just sign with a label, get this music out, because at this point, we're just waiting to get started, you know? We ended up signing with Columbia Records, which is on the East Coast in New York. Donny Einer, he was the head of Columbia Records at the time. We were like, wow, this is the label of Bob Dylan. Actually, the day we were signing the contract, we were sitting in his office, and he's like, please play a song for me. And he took down this acoustic guitar, and it said, "Love you, Donny." And then heart, Bob, and it was Bob Dylan, okay? So we were on the 56th floor in Manhattan, and we played That Great Love Sound for him, which was the single off of our first full-length album. And then we signed the contract.
What did that feel like, that moment? Columbia Records is a big deal.
I know, it was so wild. We were ecstatic, and we just really felt, I mean, it was our dream sort of coming true, but not yet, because we wanted to get out and release the album and tour and, just go around the world and play our music. It was just very exciting. I remember calling my parents and I was like, we just signed a $2 million record contract, Mom. I'm so proud of you. It was bizarre. It was kind of surreal, but it was super fun. We were having a party in the hotel, dancing all night. And
fantastic. So how would you describe Ravenettes' sound? You've been making music for a long time, so obviously it has evolved throughout the years.
Right.
But if there's a red thread to a the Ravionette sound, right. What would it be?
I think that our sound is like this, you know, it really is, we're sort of standing on the shoulders of this rock and roll tradition that's very American, but it's not like bluesy music. It's more kind of like Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, Everly Brothers. It's these very simple pop sensibility songs that are timeless. There's a certain dissonance, and because we have a lot of sort of dissonance in our music and distortion, and so it has that edge to it, but it has the sweetness of classic songwriting. And then I would say we have a very sort of signature vocal candy harmonies with the two of us singing. I think that's very distinct Ravionettes. And I remember someone saying that it really sounds like surfing in the rain, which I think, so it has that Nordic tone as well, the melancholy or the sort of Scandi Nordic sound as well, but very American and with surf guitars. And yeah, I guess that was a very long explanation, but I think that's part of it.
No, it's great. So America was a good fit for you guys?
Yeah, for sure. Sune, who writes the songs in the band, he's very inspired by, or was at least, you know, by the beat poets. And so it does have a very distinct American, it's a little bit like a voyeuristic view on American pop culture somehow. Mm-hmm. Not really being part of it, because coming from Denmark and growing up in the countryside, but this fascination with this iconic sort of American pop upbringing.
A lot of people sort of imagine that being a rock star, which you did become, and making music is about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. What was your experience of the music business? I assume that the sex, drugs, and rock and roll may not always be as fun as it sounds. Okay. What was your experience like?
I mean, we've been around for a long time now. I mean, we released our first album in 2002 in Denmark, actually. So, you know, it's 22 years.
Yeah.
So I would say that there's a lot of different periods in the Ravionettes' life. Some more destructive and volatile and debauched than others. And I mean, we've definitely had the sex, drugs, and rock and roll periods and times in our lives. But honestly, I think what we learned pretty quickly was, you know, how do we keep the artistic drive alive? How do we nurture the art in it? And how to stay creative and inspired, and how to actually play concerts and be present? Because I feel like there was a time when it was so much that when you're playing 230 shows a year, there's a certain point where you're just not really even there anymore. So I think what we've really learned is we'd like to be present, stay somehow inspired and creatively healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't have much faith in or believe in the, you know, drugs or intoxicated lifestyle being the muse for art at all. I don't believe in that. So yeah, really staying lit
yeah.
in your head and in your body and in your spirit. And so that's become more of a focus, I would say.
Mm-hmm. What are the highs and lows of your experiences?
There's different perspectives. You could look at high and lows in terms of career situations, but you can also look at personal experiences. For us, definitely a highlight was performing the David Letterman show.
Oh, yeah.
Twice. That was such a cultural institution.
Yes.
And to be able to reach that many people, I don't even know how many million people watched that show. That was quite something. I think we were the first Danish band to play David Letterman. And so I would say like things like that have been, you know, playing Glastonbury Festival or playing these sort of markers for us that just felt like, wow, we made it. Playing Royal Albert Hall and playing just like things like that.
Yeah.
Opening for Depeche Mode on a big tour, playing stadiums was a huge experience as well. So I would say things like that, but
It's nice that you have to think about that. That means that there hasn't been many of those.
Well, I mean, I think that at a certain point in our career, we felt that we had reached the status quo, a little bit of an experience of coming back to America, playing the same clubs with fewer people, not being able to, I don't know, just a sense of, are people even listening to our albums anymore? I mean, that's when we actually ended up taking a five-year break from 2017 until 2022. We had a five-year complete break from the Ravenettes and actually not really knowing whether we were going to pick it up again. Or so I would say, yeah, and that was definitely because we were sort of stunted. And also, like I was talking about earlier, this notion of, are we even inspired anymore? Do we even still have love for this music and this band? And do people still want to hear us? And so I think we just needed a little bit of a time out to figure out whether that creative spark was still there and do other things. So I would say that was a low. But on the other hand, I think it was healthy. Mm-hmm. And I will say there's been times in our career when Soon and I have been on stage and we really haven't had a good relationship. Mm-hmm. And we've played shows where we
between the two of us,
mm-hmm. just not even being able to have eye contact.
Oh,
and it's just such an estranged experience because, like, it's just been too much.
How does that affect the music?
Yeah, it just feels disconnected. So I suppose that's the internal experience of a low when you're not in a good place with each other and the working relationship is not doing well. I often think about that as that was for sure a low in our band. We really couldn't stand each other at a certain point of time.
Well, which is normal.
But, and it is. I mean, this is the thing you hear about bands all the time, right? It's such a strain on a relationship to be together 24 hours a day. And like in this really sort of adrenaline-fueled place of going on stage every night and having to perform. And at a certain point, you're just emptied out, dried out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we've had sometimes like that.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah. Honestly, even a marriage, I don't think you spent time with each other like that.
No.
And you don't see parts of each other where you're just like, I can't believe you just did that. Also, I have to say, doing interviews and you're sitting there next to each other and I'm like, did he really just say that one more time? I can't, I mean, come on, come up with something more fun or more original or more. And I think we had that experience with, we just got tired of ourselves and each other.
It's a long time to spend together.
Mm-hmm.
You created a family here in LA. You got married, you had a daughter, and you managed to keep your career running parallel with this.
Right.
How does one's creative energy change when one becomes a mother and has a family? You know, you have domestic duties and responsibilities. How does that affect one's creative life?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think this is something that should be talked about a lot more. It's like how to be, how to create that. I mean, this is like such a huge topic, honestly.
Yeah, we could talk about
it. We could talk about this for a long time because, I mean, I think within the arts, we're really just now starting to recognize and understand what it means to be a woman and have both a career and the motherhood and balancing that. For me, I knew that I wanted to have that part of my life also, you know, to be a family and to have a family and to have a child. But it was definitely, I mean, Molly came on tour with me when she was like literally 3 months old.
Wow.
And really what I was missing was some role model, someone to talk to, someone that could share some kind of experience with me. What about maternity leave when you're an independent rock star? That doesn't exist. Molly was on tour with us the first 2 years of her life because I was still breastfeeding. So yeah. Sometimes her father was there, or my sister, or my mom, or my mother-in-law at the time. And I guess I wish that someone would be there helping me out with Molly. That was challenging. I worked it out. But I do remember Suna. Damn, Suna. I do remember Sune having a hard time embracing that part of my life. I remember he was like, please don't talk about motherhood at interviews. And I'm like, why not? The most radical thing ever is being able to be a mom and play rock and roll like this. What's not to be really impressed, you know? So I think he was maybe a little bit more stuck in a very old-fashioned perspective on being a rock and roller. I'm like, this is the most rock and roll I've been in my life. It's like being able to do this at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did it. We did it. I played and I stayed active. And I also still managed to be a mom. And I think Molly, I'm pretty sure she'll say that she hasn't suffered too much. Maybe at a certain point in her life, she'll be sitting with a therapist complaining about her mom going on tour. But I suppose it's just a different approach. Mm-hmm. But what I have missed is more of having someone to talk to about it and someone to share that lifestyle with, because there hasn't been many people that I know that have done that.
I can imagine. Your daughter, Molly, is born with two cultures. Her dad that you mentioned is American. So she's Danish-American. Do you find that this is a privilege or is it a curse?
Yeah, no, I think mostly it's a privilege. I was talking to someone in Denmark a few weeks ago who was like, come on, that's amazing. She has the two best citizenships of the world in a way, you know, to be Danish and American and have that in her life. And those options and possibilities that she has, it's quite a privilege. But of course, it's also, what do you call that in English, premise in her life and in our life is this being torn between geographical places and cultures. I have just been away from Molly for 2 months while she's been here and I've been in Denmark. The missing is a lot. So I suppose that's part of it as well. But mostly we feel, especially now that Molly's 16 and she really feels the privilege of, wow, I actually have these two countries that I belong to, and she's lived in Denmark and gone to school there. She really understands what kind of a country it is, and she really connects with that. And then she's a very SoCal girl as well. So I think she really understands now that's a huge sort of privilege that she has in her life, actually. But of course, you know, that we are torn also. And sometimes I'm like, wow, she really is a different cultural breed than me. She grew up with different experience, sense of weather and just cultural upbringing, just different literature, different TV than me. There's just something about that she really is a little American and I'm completely Danish. Well, except I'm actually a quarter Chinese also. But
yes, your grandfather was Chinese, right?
Yeah.
And she does speak Danish, you told me.
She speaks Danish.
How did you manage to do that?
By being very stubborn about it. I was really determined for her to have that. I remember reading about being bilingual and how important it is to actually hear the language spoken to you, especially the first 2 years of your life. And that made an impression on me that it really is to hear, to get the sounds really embedded in you. She was really annoyed with it. Why do I have to speak, you know, Danish? And she would speak English back to my mom, for instance, and my mom would speak Danish to her. So she was not really wanting to do it at first. But then she realized that in Denmark that the kids didn't speak English.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So then she was like, okay, if I want to communicate with the kids, I better start speaking Danish. But yeah, very had to stay on it for sure when she was little. She was not happy about it.
And you traveled the world on tours. You've been to Hong Kong. Right. You were in India at some point in your life studying, I believe.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think I have wanderlust in me. Even before the Ravenettes, I have, partly because of my Chinese heritage as well. My grandfather took the whole family to China a couple of times. Well, 3-4 times I've been there with him. First time when I was 3 years old. And yeah, I guess I've always been really, I've had that curiosity about traveling around and meeting different cultures, hence also studying Indian classical vocals when I was at the conservatory. I did an exchange there. some kind of, yeah, like I say, wanderlust. Also, I sailed across the Atlantic Ocean on this two-mast wooden schooner when I was 19 years old. So I guess I have an adventure in me in that sense. Yeah, it's a drive that I have. You learn a lot about yourself when you meet different cultures than your own. And I think also you can then actually really appreciate what you come from and understand it.
Is that something you want for your daughter to do too?
I want my daughter to do what she wants for her. That's the most important thing for me, is just for her to figure out what she wants to do.
Sharon, what do you like doing when you're not working? Do you have a hobby?
My hobbies?
Yeah, or do you have, yeah, do you knit and...
My hobbies, yeah, I love cooking. For me, that's a very life-affirming kind of sensual experience. I love fermenting stuff and making kombucha and sourdough bread. And I like that. I feel it's very meditative for me. When I'm here, I really love gardening. I have a huge garden, and I have an avocado tree and a grapefruit tree and lemon trees and a persimmon tree and a loquat tree. And so I'm really into sort of California natives. And so I love that. That's also very meditative for me, being in the garden. I would say that those are like some kind of big hobbies for me.
If I speak to you in 10 years, what is your dream reply if I ask you what you are up to?
Wow, that's a tough question. I'd like to be able to say that I'm still artistically engaged in creating. I also am currently doing a practice-based artistic research project, and I really like that nerdy sort of investigation, more academic approach, and hopefully living really close to my daughter.
And my final question to you, do you have a bucket list of things that you want to experience in your life still, both personally and creatively? Things that you need to tick off? And if yes, what would they be?
My gosh, I feel like I should be a lot more ambitious than I am. But I guess for me, it's much more related to being in my life in a healthy way, both, you know, in mind and body and spirit and art. And I mean, that's really the thing that I'm mostly focused on. I don't have this. I mean, it'd be fun to win a Grammy, but my happiness is not dependent on that for sure. It's just not. I mean, it'd be amazing to be touring with the Ravenettes. Imagine if we suddenly had this huge hit, a Billboard top 10 hit song. That would be fun, right? Those kinds of things would be fun, but mainly I just want to be strong and healthy and creative and that kind of stuff.
Thank you so much, Sharon, for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
For today's episode, Sharon Fogh chose Jørdef Willumsens En Bjergbestigerske, or A Mountain Climber from 1912, from the collection of the National Gallery of Denmark.
You've been listening to Danish Originals, a podcast series created in partnership with the American Friends of the National Gallery of Denmark and the National Gallery of Denmark. This series is sponsored by Scandesign Foundation and Studio Haslund. I'm your host, Tina Jung Christensen. This podcast is directed by Christian D. Brun and produced by Theresa Lai and May 11 Projects. Original music by Joachim Svahr, executive produced by Christian D. Brun and Tina Jung Christensen. Please subscribe to Danish Originals wherever you get your podcasts. Share it with others, leave a review, find us on danishoriginals.com and follow us on AFSMK's Instagram, Facebook and LinkedIn. Last but not least, we invite you to donate to the American Friends of Statens Museum for Kunst and become a patron. We will see you next week.